authentic wheel spin. Did you catch that audio? This is the cottage, Gethley, where my dad moved in with the Brookses in 1953, soon after the coronation, with the intention of writing.
And he was here how long?
For about a year. Unfortunately, the writing didn't quite pan out, and he was effectively ejected from the premises.
I am desperately unfit now to take my chance with life. I am a prisoner in hiding, a prisoner of war. I cannot venture forth until the war is over. The war that is being fought with my soul for terrain and my heart.
He really thought he ought to be able to have you if he wanted you.
The year is whipping away, like the last foot of a cobra vanishing down a drainpipe.
Something frightened him.
I know there is nothing to hope for, that treachery is all that lies ahead.
She stood on a grave, poured paraffin over herself, and set herself on fire.
You could make a whole novel out of it. It's the material of novels. It's very weird.
It is that element of calculation in it that shames me and makes it murder.
Hello, I'm Saul Wordsworth, author, musician, journalist, and son of former Fleet Street journalist Christopher Wordsworth, whose diaries are the subject of this podcast series. Aside from bundles of books and a wardrobe packed with ink-stained, cigarette-singed clothes, the diaries were all he left behind. Through them, I hope to better understand this mysterious, difficult, but brilliant man, a man with a complex past, a novel in his head, and an unnamed event,
that moment in Iraq,
on his conscience. At the end of the previous episode, my father, 38, divorced, penniless, and with two children left behind unsupported, was about to make the move from London to Snowdonia, North Wales, to a cottage rented by Eleanor and Jeremy Brooks at the suggestion of Jeremy's brother, where he could work on his novel.
So there we were landed with him.
Eleanor was an aspiring artist, though she had her hands full with young children, and Jeremy a budding novelist and playwright. Both were in their mid-20s. Growing up, I remember Eleanor and Jeremy Brooks. We attended a party at the very same remote cottage, Gethley, in the 1980s, a short but treacherous drive up from the village of Llanfrothen in what is known as the Croeser Valley. I recall vividly how beforehand my father told me these people had been good to him and for me to be on my best behaviour, which he would never normally do. Clearly, he didn't want me acting up in any way, or coming over as a chip off the old block. He wanted them to see that he'd raised a child who, unlike him, could behave. I met Eleanor again back in 2007, when she was an 82-year-old widow, and I was in the area on a fact-finding mission about my father. Having been given her number by my dad's friend Ivor, I found her initially unwilling to meet me, since she felt she would only have bad things to say about someone who, at the time, she regarded almost as an enemy. But in the end, she relented, and we had a fascinating discussion, albeit captured on a fairly basic tape recorder.
Well, exactly. If you don't do it now, we may all be dead.
When in 2021, I decided to turn the diaries into a podcast series. I rang Eleanor, seeking permission to use the audio from our interview, though ostensibly it was to find out whether she was still alive.
Somehow, it came as no surprise that after two rings, she answered, sharp as a tack. Though 97 and somewhat diminished, she is and remains a force of nature. I subsequently went up to re-interview her at Gethley, the same cottage my father had moved into nearly 70 years earlier, hoping for new material and also to secure better quality audio. Where appropriate, I shall blend the two interviews.
We took it on, first of all, in 1953 on a 30-year lease. We didn't have a washing machine. We didn't have, for the first year, we didn't have electricity or running water, with just sort of rag rugs on the floor and no heating except the open fire. We were a bit crazy.
I think we'd been here 2 or 3 months before he came. And we arrived in June, and the coronation celebrations and the scent of Everest were being celebrated too.
Taking in strangers was very much the kind of thing people did in those days, especially in the country. There was a post-war idealism, particularly amongst artists, and it didn't cost an awful lot to live if you had somewhere cheap, like the Brookses did. When my father fetched up at their door, it was the first time they'd set eyes on him, but they welcomed a fellow writer, not least because they thought an extra pair of hands would be useful. But as Eleanor told me, that's not how things panned out.
He looked after the fire because it was the only... he was very naughty, he really was. But he would get firewood because it immediately affected his immediate comfort. And then he'd sit by the fire, soaking it up. He wouldn't know any gardening or cooking or washing up or anything. He was very naughty.
When asked to garden, he would reply simply, "It's not my garden." When requested to help with the washing up, he would say, "It's not my kitchen." The tone was set.
And he was very, very angry and frightened when he came here. You could see it in his eyes. He'd been very hurt by something, or damaged, or he'd done something wrong himself, which has made him very frightened about retribution. I know, but I don't know what happened, you see. I don't know why he was so like that. He's a desperate man.
This despair, not black, but limitless. A violin on a refuse heap. A curlew's song in the mist. A child with cancer. It wells up uncontrollably at the oddest times, but it is with me all the while.
With a war and a wife already under his belt, and perhaps some unknown or unnamed event on his conscience, my father cut an awkward, difficult figure at this time, certainly around Eleanor. She describes him as a glowering presence, not be easy in his stance, and emitting a steady stream of sarcastic invective, apparently unable to stop the bitterness from seeping out. He was, she said, in a bad way.
He was like a wounded bull. He wouldn't be pathetic, you know, he wouldn't allow himself to show as pathetic or needing sympathy. He was too proud, I suppose, for that, yes.
It is undeniable that my life is a perfect bit of planning. I have been broken right down to my component parts. It has been a most intricate piece of work, every apparently disconnected incident contributing to the meticulous pattern. So deft, so devious that it must have a purpose. Perhaps to cut my moorings and set me adrift in a cockle's hell of thoughts and words. Make a writer of me in spite of everything.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Which brings us neatly to the novel, his very reason for being there. With the matter of his survival resolved, at least for now, at a safe distance from his responsibilities, and with a haven in which to hunker down, here was a golden opportunity for my dad to put pen to paper and make good on his potential, or at least his assertion. But that is not what transpired. Instead, and having opted out of household chores, my father had time on his hands. Lots of it. Some of this was spent reading, a constant no matter his circumstances, with books borrowed from the local library in Port Madoc. Every 2 weeks he would collect his national security from the Labour Exchange at Penrhyndeidraeth, their patients tested by declaration of himself as a writer, for which there were, unsurprisingly, no jobs in the area. Evenings were passed at the Brondano Arms in the village, often with Jeremy, often on Jeremy's account. And with a trout stream running in front of the cottage, its gush audible when myself and producer Paul arrived at Eleanor's, the temptation proved too great.
I was outraged, really, that Jeremy spent time and money on him. You know, that wasn't what I bargained for.
Your money?
My money, yeah. They also spent, Jeremy too, spent hours and hours and hours fishing, which wasn't very profitable because there aren't really any much to eat on the fish in the river here. Sometimes you get a fish about that long, brown trout, delicious, but... When he ought to have been working, I thought, I didn't understand that writers had to spend a lot of time fishing or something equivalent.
Where, in fact, have I ever felt I belonged? In the dark with my darling and fishing the upper Wye. Fishing for trout in a peculiar and haunted river. This awful self-consciousness. The womb and the grave, the only places safe from scrutiny and criticism. The hoarding of private moments. The feeling of security in hotels. Strange houses where toilet and bathroom are together. But it is true that the love of trout fishing has been almost as powerful a base to me as the love of women. There is more than a superficial analogy here. The playing of a fish can be compared to the delaying of sexual gratification. The prolongation of coitus.
A quick summary. My dad was rude and discourteous to the lady of the house. He was not offering any rent or sharing the chores, nor was he writing. Furthermore, he was taking Jeremy away from his own writing and his family and taking his money. I think that's a full house, Dad. The Brookses had given him time to find his feet, but after a few months,
when nothing had changed, they started voicing their understandable frustrations. Eleanor Brooks.
I think Jeremy started to say, you know, you're not really writing, are you? And why don't you look for a job? So we went out to the pub, Jeremy and I went out to the pub, and Christopher stayed back and babysit. And when we got back from the pub, he'd left some papers on the table with handwriting on. And this was supposed to be his novel, or pages from his novel, which he'd sort of dropped or something like that. And I read a few pages of it, and it was just cliché nonsense. Carruthers strode out of the jungle and stuff like that. It was complete nonsense. I think he borrowed a book from the local library and just copied it out, probably made a few changes.
Routine. The first lesson to any child should be the uses of routine. Proof that a little done each day, however tedious and obdurate, amounts to something. The grammar and syntax of life that enables us to speak its language. I used to leave everything to the last moment. Look at me now. I have not even studied to survive, and I cannot overnight it, as it were. Revise life itself for tomorrow's test, as I used to my prep under the bedclothes with a torch.
When I was growing up, my dad continued to leave everything to the last moment. One of his favourite phrases, procrastination is the thief of time, he would utter to me as a warning, though it felt more like he was saying it to himself. Yet he didn't heed his own advice, because once a month, without fail, he would find himself caught in his own essay crisis, one that dominated our entire household. It would coincide with his latest roundup for The Guardian, The Observer, or The Good Book Guide, and would manifest as a growing sense of panic, my dad speed-reading his way through multiple proof copies for a review in our sitting room, until, with the deadline fast approaching, he would disappear upstairs. It's early morning, 1983, and my 10-year-old self is taking a cup of tea to my father's study at the back of our Harpenden home. He has been up for 2 whole days and nights, working on his latest review piece. Aged 69, he suffered a heart attack the year before. Since the early hours, the house has been filled with the distinctive sound of 2-finger typing. I knock and enter. The air hangs heavy with tobacco. The right side of his face is tan with nicotine from the perpetual corkscrew of smoke emanating from the cigarette that sits characteristically on his lips, but remains forever uninhaled. I place the tea next to him and collect the empty cup, but he is so deep in concentration, he's unaware of me. His shirt is stained and singed on the plateau where his hefty stomach catches, invariably, a full 3 inches of ash. I brush the ash from his belly and onto a floor thick with crumpled drafts before exiting. When, eventually, he is done, and the taxi arrives to courier his copy all the way to Fleet Street, he slumps downstairs, exhausted. He turns to me and says,
"This isn't proper writing, you know, old son."
Back in 1953, and unlike my father, Eleanor's husband Jeremy, who would go on to become an acclaimed novelist and chief reader for the National Theatre, was writing hard. In fact, unbeknownst to my dad, he was fashioning a comic novel whose central character, Oliver Earle, was very obviously and entirely based on him. The Water Carnival was to be Jeremy Brooks's first published work, a fictional reimagining of the Croyser Valley relocated to an island just off the Thames, and featuring, with name changes, all the local characters. In it, Jeremy mimics and lampoons my dad at his most pompous, whilst leaving the door open to the possibility that maybe, just maybe, he may actually, one day, make something of himself.
The world has let loose its dogs on me, and they have torn the fabric of my life to tatters. All I have left is the knowledge of my own uniqueness. That, added Oliver, and my talent. If you've really got a talent of some sort, George said, you're lucky. Most people haven't. It must be a great comfort to you. I don't think you quite understand, he said. Mine is no ordinary talent. I'm not one of your basket weavers or penny press scribblers. He burst into alarming laughter, and then was as suddenly grave again. I am on the threshold, he said, of a work which I sincerely believe may change the whole course of 20th century literature.
The acceptance of the Water Carnival by a London publishing house was the cause of a memorable incident down at the English local, the Brondano Arms.
Was it always called? Is it Brondor? Yeah.
No, well, it's pronounced the Brondano Arms, but it's known locally as the Ring. It's where, in particular, the English contingent, the English visitors used to drink, so my father with the likes of Philip O'Connor and John Jones and Jeremy Brooks used to come here. Are you open?
Yeah.
Okay, right, thank you. Thank you very much. This is the site of the often quoted incident where my dad was playing darts.
Jeremy went to the pub. Christopher was in the pub playing darts, his usual. He earns a lot of beers, I think, playing darts.
60. Jeremy said, Christopher, they've taken my book. 60. Oh, where have they taken it? Christopher, they've taken my book. Where?
Oh, yes, where have they taken it?
My dad broke off from his darts and said, oh, really? Where?
I mean, that was a remark that was repeated, and everyone sort of revelled in it.
I've heard it before from Ivor told it to me. And it encapsulates Dad.
It does, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Perfectly.
The wit.
But also the bitterness. Hasn't done it, someone else has done it.
Yeah.
Because all of this, it's all rather, it's very funny, but actually, where does it leave him?
Well, actually, you see, he doesn't come out of it badly in a way, because really what it is a nakedness.
Mm.
And the really bad people in this world manage to cover up and use their badness, their anger, for evil purposes. He never did that.
No.
No, it all just came out. It's sort of almost childish.
Mm.
So there is a sort of innocence there. He was very funny. He was entertaining.
Mm.
He was unkind, but he was entertaining. You know, if you weren't at the receiving end of his bitter remarks, he was very amusing.
Don't you ever feel he's a mystery man? Whispered Dickie. Those whiskers, the shabby old suit, and that terrific third programme voice, turning up here as if he owned the place. Privately, I had to admit that I felt the man's fascination as much as anyone. And yet, having had closer contact with him than they, I knew, or thought I knew, that in reality, he was nothing to get excited about. A self-confident little sponger with a way of putting himself across so as to suspend people's critical faculties. But a little voice at the back of my mind whispered, perhaps he is a genius, better be careful. You don't want to look silly later on.
What'll it be for you then, Paul?
Yard of ale?
Don't think so. Are you having a drink?
No, I probably won't.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study,
People that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My father rarely let his guard down with the Brookses, and certainly not Eleanor. But one day, when he'd been lodging at Gethley for a few months, and the two of them found themselves alone in a car, he began to open up about his past, in particular his marriage.
It was the complete idiocy on his part that he lost his first wife. He didn't write to her. 3 years he was in India without leave, and he didn't write her a letter. I said, what the hell did you think she would think? Well, she knew I loved her. He was
a foolish man.
He was a foolish man, yes. He was probably damaged by other people to start with, you know. The foolishness goes on.
My heart crying, my soul sighing, for Joan in the Orient, for a second chance with each. I thought that both were to be part of my life forever, that I should repair remissions in good time. But because my loss of both was abrupt, inexplicable and unjust, I am constantly rummaging for something mislaid, like a man who has dropped his ignition key in a sump of oil and is groping with his arm up to the elbow.
Now, didn't someone mention fishing?
Hello? Hi, Francis.
Mind your head.
That's the voice of Francis Ullman, Eleanor's next-door neighbour, though round here, next door means over the hillside, or on the other side of the valley, a 10-minute drive up and down rugged trails. He has been resident here since 1970, but would visit regularly as a child.
Tea, coffee, wine...
I'm personally okay.
I'd take a cup of tea, please.
Francis is an interesting character in his own right, an observer of the valley for the last 50 years, and a font of local knowledge, someone who will come in handy in later episodes.
I've been coming since I was a child, because my father got this place in 1951, when I was 8, and I absolutely fell in love with nature. I was receiving a posh education in London, but I've got a feral side to my personality, and I just love being in the countryside.
And that's when you first encountered my father?
That was when I first encountered your father, but I think I was only about 8 or 9 when I did. And he taught me to fish, which was very kind of him, because my father never, ever spent very much time with me. But I met your father, and he enjoyed having a little... apprentice. He was not a threatening figure at all. He was, he just treated me as an ordinary individual. I don't think he didn't patronize me in any way, took me seriously. And I was just another person who he enjoyed teaching how to fish.
My father was good with children. In fact, he would often gravitate towards them at social gatherings, probably because he himself was one, and because children are less judgmental, unaware of notions of past or reputation. Perhaps he simply wanted to give them something he himself missed out on as a child. Or maybe he was just making amends.
It is important that I am clear in this. I act as though I am a person who thinks a vast amount of others. I am extravagantly obliging, quick to express sympathy. I now write regular replies to the few who write to me. If I cannot keep one of my dingy appointments, I never leave anyone in the air. I go to endless pains for children. But I am these things in a doomed, pathetic attempt to rescue my foundered reputation. My experiences have shattered out of me the ability to think of anyone but myself. Not in a cold, selfish, and therefore sensible way, but in the way a man in pain is dominated by it to the exclusion of everything. Is that quite true? Do I wince or not wince for others, because for myself?
I just remember him as being a decent, quiet, rumbling sort of man, a roly-poly figure. Subsequently, after he'd left this area, I used to read his rugby reviews for The Observer and realised he was an absolutely brilliant writer. I don't think he could write at length, but his reviews were just diamond sharp. They were absolutely beautiful.
In sharp contrast to Francis's experience...
Can you remember, Villada, when you first encountered my dad?
I remember very vividly, yes.
That's the voice of Villada Barlow, a major name in contemporary British art and a passing friend of my father's in the 1950s. I was lucky enough to visit her and her artist husband, Fabian, at their home in Finsbury Park, just a few months prior to her death in March 2023, where she recounted to me their first terrifying visit to the Brondano Arms as budding young art students.
We were not expecting the hostile atmosphere and this icy silence that fell when we came in. There was this extremely loud, raucous group in the corner. There was a very large man with an unruly beard. I know that the unruly bearded man ended up being Christopher. Anyway, it was a very boisterous evening and quite edgy, extremely edgy. And it eventually emerged that Fabian's father was Mervyn Peake.
Mervyn Peake was author of the famous Gormenghast books, enough to trigger a jealousy in my dad that would manifest in the only way he knew how.
And I think this unleashed a kind of vituperous comment from Christopher Wordsworth that was a little bit tricky to stomach, you know, but the way he commanded through even his silence and his garrulous conversation, how he could command an entire room full of people, was both extraordinarily entertaining, but also terrifying, because you knew one foot wrong and you would get it in the neck. A huge presence and a huge character. That's how I remember him. In my mind, in my memory, he seemed almost like a big physical person as well. So it was like the whole deal.
My dad was stocky, but definitely short. It's clear Villada felt his presence as much as his stature, exacerbated no doubt by the beard and the brooding silence. For a modern-day comparison, think Logan Roy from Succession, in both appearance and temperament.
I don't think I ever quite gathered what Christopher Wordsworth did, you know, but then as time went on, I became familiar with his writing in the papers and things, and it was sort of very thrilling to think that we had encountered him at that time. But there was a sort of tribal atmosphere in the Proiser Valley that was not entirely comfortable.
It would be incorrect to suggest that my father wasn't writing at all while lodging with the Brookses. Though showing few signs of daily commitment to the task, an outline of a semi-autobiographical novel emerges around this time, one that would hold fairly firm for the next few years.
The essence is this. A creature, melodramatic, lost in fiction, hypersensitive regarding himself, repeating the errors which have brought him to his present state so that this book is a microcosm of his past life, but able to stand wryly apart sometimes, lucky him. A very, very deep love of the best writing and intolerance of the pretentious, an unerring instinct for the pretentious in people as well, misanthropic by experience but not in practice, country lover. Self-destruction theme, the incoherence of his own thoughts about himself, the total inability to understand others, the still sad music of concupiscence, an object of laughter, pity, but sufficiently robust occasionally to turn the tables.
By the end of Diary One, certain themes have begun to emerge. A resentment of his own father, a lamentation for wasted years and squandered talent, the loss of his lyrical powers, a ceaseless blame game trained on anyone but himself, deep confusion about other people and the world around him, perplexity at his own nature, desperation at the breakdown of his marriage, the agonies of writer's block. But in particular, there is one subject that my father comes back to time and time again, something I know nothing about, and which I cannot ignore. An unnamed event that took place during the war while he was stationed in Iraq.
More than any other in my life, I have been the prisoner of two events. Striking a pregnant Joan, and that moment in Iraq. And there is an interconnection. At least the guilt of one hampered my maintaining my innocence, come what may in the other. Above all, the two calamities of Iraq and Joan, so complementary, destroyed any creative impulse, and left me with just the idea of myself as a writer, a hull without sails or engine. The instinct to break cover, to shout, "Here I am," in order to avoid the terrible moment of discovery, the pounce that Adam felt among the leafage. Hence, Iraq.
I wondered if he had something on his conscience or was actually afraid of something catching up with him. But it does seem that he didn't have less opportunities when he came out of the Indian Army than anyone else would have. Mm. So he made a mess somewhere, I think, of something. Something frightened him.
I wonder if you can help me.
Yeah, sure.
My father volunteered for the Indian Army during World War II, and he was posted to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I found his Indian Army details in your books here, but I can't seem to find any reference to Iraq.
I visited the British Library in the hope of trying to discover what exactly happened in Iraq. His records in the Indian Army files were fairly basic, but then they asked if I'd like to see his war record, which was residing in their vaults. I had no idea such a thing existed. Of course, I said yes.
So I'll come back in about an hour then?
Yeah, just go in about an hour. Just go directly to my colleagues there and they will issue to you, show you a card, and they will tell you where to sit and you can take pictures of it.
Thank you.
Okay.
What I uncovered at the British Library is for the next episode. It does seem that between his arrival at Gethley as a near vagrant in the summer of 1953, when according to Eleanor he couldn't get any lower, and the following spring, my father had established a foothold in the local community and found friends, many of whom would remain so until his death. Despite a wicked tongue, thin skin and sporadic temper, there was great affection for him. He was unquestionably a rogue, but as the cliché rolls, a lovable one. To most. Not Eleanor, But then she probably isn't the best introduction to my father, as she witnessed him at his lowest ebb, apparent in his inability to pull his weight, and offers up a picture of my dad I don't quite recognise. But as a man of secrets and numerous different sides and contradictions to his character, it is typical that he would present in different ways to different people. By turns bitter, unkind, generous, funny, ferocious, desperate, shy, loud, menacing, benign.
Well, he was a delightful source of gossip. I mean, people revel in that kind of thing, particularly in the country where, you know, you need some characters, don't you? So he was a character. And I suppose anybody who's a character has certain qualities that are admirable, even if he's a bad character. I mean, like not being afraid and being oneself.
Yeah.
Hiding and being a hypocrite. He wasn't a hypocrite, you see. He may have been a bit of a con man, but he wasn't a hypocrite. You know, he was never without a woman.
After less than a year, my father's time with the Brookses and their patients had reached its limit. Eleanor used the impending arrival of their third child to ask him to leave. In true melodramatic style, he records what I take to be this moment in his diaries.
Today, the 2nd of the 4th, 1954, my affairs tilted perceptibly beyond the angle of safety. The subterfuge was harmless and transparent enough, but people always distrust those whom they deceive and despise those taken in by deception. I am filled with the sense of having experienced it all before. I know the tiniest forms of life that animate such a situation, the infusoria, the medusa, daphnia of such relationships. And beneath all the currents and eddies of vacillating opinion, flows the stream of my conviction broad and deep, that people are savage, avaricious and trivial, and that my relations with them are doomed to worsen day by day and stage by stage.
According to Eleanor, my dad was extremely angry and bitter when she asked him to leave. To soften the blow, Jeremy Brooks had lined up a job for him at a cafe in Port Marion. Eleanor describes him as looking stricken with terror as her husband prepared to drive him to the interview. But he secured the job, a position that came with a room, though his duties were unclear.
I don't quite know what he did. There were certain things he couldn't do because he had no shoes.
Right.
The most respectable footgear he had was a pair of Wellingtons.
Shoes or otherwise, my father settled into his job, pretty much the first of his life, age 39. But he wasn't there long.
At this time, above all, I need a woman, for the reality of passion and as a helpmeet. The fact that I allow my present circumstance to veto this, and defer such an acquisition to a vague later period when things have righted themselves, shows how I have let myself be dominated by the pattern of mundane trivialities.
It was indeed a woman, a beautiful American heiress, no less, who was about to insert herself into his life.
He had this extraordinary thing with Sue Russell.
A woman who also happened to be the daughter-in-law of Bertrand Russell, Lord Russell, Nobel Prize winner and one of the most famous men in the world. Their relationship would send shockwaves through the valley, knock my father further off course than he could possibly have imagined, and change everything. Next time on Devil in the Wilderness.
I have a recollection, he welled up with tears, because it is an enormously sad story.
And they sat side by side on carved chairs, and John Russell gave her to Christopher.
I'm collecting a copy of my father's war record.
Can I see your card, please?
Yeah.
Anywhere beyond that pillar you're allowed to sit.
The machete to cut my way out is not my pen, but between my thighs. We are in the antechamber of disaster.
Devil in the Wilderness was written and produced by me, Saul Wordsworth.
I should be homesick if I had a home to be sick in.
Original music from the series, such as this track, is also by me and is available on Spotify and other streaming services. Links in the show notes.
Something frightened me.
The executive producer of the series is Paul Kobrak. The voice of my father is performed by Chris Porter.
It is as if something in my head has given way to let in that cold greyness.
Excerpts from the novel The Water Carnival by Jeremy Brooks are read by Ian Pollock.
He could never have been what he wanted to be, which was a great novelist, because he was too self-absorbed and self-obsessed. He was no other subject but himself, really.
Time that was once the dog at my heels is now the wolf at my door.
How do you propose to shift him? Continued Dickie. Have you ever tried even talking to him about the future? It just isn't possible. It's like trying to get a grip on a piece of wet soap in a hot bath. I know he's pompous and belligerent and all that, but there's something rather appealing about his helplessness. He can't do a thing for himself, you know. Not a thing. All his background and education have fitted him for a life in which there would always be a sufficiency of money. And now he finds himself without any. He's like a lost child. What's the use of having your head stuffed full of Latin and Greek quotations if you can't sew on a button? My head, said Dickie, is equally stuffed, but it hasn't prevented me from learning how to sew on a button. Ah, but you don't think you're a genius.
The softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.